Hello everyone, you're listening to a podcast about buildings and cities. I'm Luke Jones.
I'm George Kinchell.
This is the second part of our examination of the works of Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown.
This time with Stephen
Isenour.
Isenour.
So we're talking about Learning from Las Vegas, which is the second of these two very influential books of architectural theory or polemics or whatever.
They're very famous. This one's more famous.
Yes, and this one is, it's more famous. It's also more polemical. It's a bit more out there. It's more radical. It's more propositional. Learning from Las Vegas theorizes the Vegas Strip at a particular moment in history, in the 60s, really, as a model for the architecture of the coming information age, in which space is no longer a central or even particularly relevant concern, and symbolism, the kind of communicative function of iconography, assumes that centrality as the real domain of creative and architectural design and reasoning. It's also, in contrast to Complexity and Contradiction, it is a collaboration. I think around the time that Complexity and Contradiction was released, Venturi married Denise Scott Brown, and Learning from Las Vegas arises out of the teaching that they were doing together at Yale School of Architecture, I guess from the sort of late 60s onwards. She was born Denise Latofsky, so she is a Jewish South African, and her training is in urbanism, or like urban studies or urban design. So the Scott Brown is from her first husband, Ronald, who I think she got married to in the early 1960s and who died very shortly afterwards.
Rather unfortunate.
Yeah, I think he had a car crash or something like that. She held on to the surname, and then she became a partner in Venturi's firm a little bit after their marriage, I think in the late 60s or something like that. And the idea, I think, she was appointed as partner in charge of urban design. And I think that the idea was that they were going to go into, having identified this big new approach to urban design, they were going to go into it in a big way. Unfortunately, sort of historically, actually the age of big urban design schemes was rather past at that point. And so in the end, to the extent that they did a lot of that kind of thing, it was mostly sort of campus design schemes and these sorts of things within the particular sort of city simulacrum of the university.
I mean, in fact, when it comes to the buildings, she will often talk about them more than he will. The lectures I've seen from him have been mainly about, he'll go through the buildings a bit, but they've always been driven by ideas. And I think he has a slight reticence to sort of talk about the business of like rectangle, the actual nitty gritty of the business of sort of rectangle arranging and how you make the light come in from here and there.
Yes, the way she talks about the buildings so in the bonus, we're going to talk about a couple of other things. One of the things we might talk about is this interview that the two of them did with Rem Koolhaas in the early 2000s, whereas he tends to veer straight back into his polemic against architecture. She's much more willing to discuss specific design decisions related to particular buildings and, you know, why they did this and that. Sorry, it's Robert Scott Brown, not Ronald. Anyway, whatever.
Ronald. Poor old Ronald.
Yeah, Robert.
Genius is a man like Norman Einstein.
Yeah, okay, that's good. That's good. As to the story of who Stephen Isenour, their third author, is, he was one of their students in the studio, which was examining this brief related to Las Vegas, which I think was the significance of A and P parking lots.
Should we go through it in turn? I mean, the authors are written Robert Venturi, Denise Scott Brown, Stephen Isenour.
Yeah.
Isenour. And I think that's kind of on purpose, whether that's by prestige or by amount of authorship.
I think that it's by prestige. In terms of the literal authorship of the text, there's a very clear continuity with the style of Complexity and Contradiction. So yeah. I imagine that's pretty evident. The interest in Las Vegas was Denise Scott Brown's initially. So I think that the two of them were both had this interest in like sort of pop kitsch, sort of commercial design. I think she'd been teaching since the early 60s and had made trips to Las Vegas and had this sort of existing interest in cataloguing sort of vulgar but interesting commercial design.
They also did trips to suburbia.
What we're looking at is the revised edition, which was brought out a bit later and which contains their subsequent, or part of their subsequent research thing, which is called Learning from Levittown.
Cool. I think we should just go through it in order. It's a book of two halves. So you've got the first part, which is about Las Vegas specifically, particularly the hotels, casinos, wedding chapels, and petrol stations of Las Vegas at that time, and their signage and car parks. And then there's a second part, which I'm sure we'll talk about at probably a greater length, but I think it'd be worth going through part one.
We can go through part one, which is the much more Las Vegas-y part.
And much less talked about.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of repeating themselves, though. Like, I do think that this stuff comes up much, but I think if you were going to characterise them, the first part is more a survey and analysis of the way Las Vegas and the Strip operate at the architectural and symbolic level, and the second part is much more about applying those insights to a polemic on what the future of architecture should be.
Works of architectural theory will often, even if it's not explicitly what they do, will kind of propose a way of looking at buildings, a sort of taxonomy or system of thinking about dividing them up. And it has a sort of model like that, and also, like works of theories, uses that to look at things, draw a conclusion, and then produce some sort of proposal. And that's something I think we've seen when we've looked at lots of different people, you know, when we've looked at Aldo Rossi or Le Corbusier, or they've all sort of done something where they have a sort of method of looking at buildings, possibly with a kind of taxonomy, or Ruskin just as truly, and then there's a middle bit of what this tool allows them to think, and then what the proposal is, to the extent that there is one. And the second part is sort of like that. The first part is, yeah, more descriptive.
So how would we sum up? What is it that they're really interested in? In Las Vegas particularly, they're interested in this newer bit where the really big casino hotels are, which is the Strip. What they're interested in trying to look at is the way in which those buildings kind of advertise themselves and the way in which they relate to the shared space of the Strip, which is, you know, it's a big road that you traditionally should drive up and down in your big sort of open top car, really, isn't it?
Like a big muscle car. Shiny, red.
Shiny, yes.
It's really slowly as well.
Top down,
probably.
Drive slowly, yes.
In the heat of the night.
Yeah.
Should we say a little bit about Las Vegas? I don't know very much about it, but I could guess.
Yeah, well, yeah, let's say a bit about it. What do we want to say?
I don't know much about the pre-Hoover Dam history. It'll probably be something like some pioneers of some sort or another, possibly religious people or maniacs or something, turned up there and didn't do very much. And then there was probably a railway. In the 20s, it was proposed to build this big dam on the Colorado River. That is now the Hoover Dam, which provided an awful, you know, provided a lot of amenity. I think at that time that the state didn't have very many people. It didn't have much economic potential in terms of sort of farming or mining or anything like that. They then produced a series of quite liberal laws on a variety of topics, including gambling and marriage, to encourage a gambling centre. And at that time, the Hoover Dam was built. And so there was water, lots of electricity in a place with that much demand. And so from
cheap land as well.
And very, very, like, the state was pretty empty. Even now, I think, apart from Las Vegas, I think 3/4 of the state lives there. Or in the...
Yeah, that sounds very plausible.
Like, broader suburbs of it. Transport was improved enormously. Lots of cheap land, potential for gambling. And it very quickly develops as a town after the war. First around a kind of old centre, you know, with the railway at one end, a grid that builds up. And then as the freeway system gets going, the interstate highways, it sort of explodes geographically. There's this big strip. There's lots of low density development around it. All of that really occurs, like, the first thing I think is probably 10 years after the war. And then the next 10 years, the strip develops. Supposedly a lot of this is built by the mafia. And it becomes this great entertainment center. In the early days, quite heavily gambling, but also shows. And there's this peculiar thing of wedding chapels as well, because it's got very permissive marriage laws.
Drive-in.
It's a fun place. Yeah, drive-in.
Yeah, so famously,
you can get married by Elvis. Or
several days into a binge, you can get married to someone by like a novelty pastor of some kind.
Yeah, credit cards accepted, which I'm sure they are everywhere. I think the Church of England must accept credit cards now, but it's a rather slow process there. You no longer have to reject Satan to get married in the Church of England. You used to have to sign a little yellow chit.
Yes. No, you don't have to worry about that. They still reject Satan. Do you reject Satan when someone gets baptized, or is that off?
No, they changed it a couple of years ago.
In the Catholic Church, you still reject Satan. I was at a Catholic baptism the other day, and they...
Do you reject Satan and all his acts? Yeah. Oh, that's what it was. Because early christenings that I went to, we had to do that. And now we don't have to reject Satan and all his acts anymore.
They're equivocating on Satan now.
It's optional. It's optional. Yeah. Well, I don't know. You know, people can have theological arguments about what all this means. You can also just take it as read.
We have to describe the urban form a bit, I think, because then you sort of understand what it is that they're so into.
Yeah, yeah. So this is that's all foreplay, really.
Yeah, it's like the strip is a really big, wide road, and then you have the casinos, but they're all set back quite far from the road because you have parking and landscaping and things in front, and then and then closer to the road, you have all sorts of signs, which obviously are alerting you to the presence of the casino, and that there's a real competitive ecology of those where they become really big.
There's massive gaps between everything. Like, there's big gaps, like gaps that would be like sort of ridiculous if you were actually walking it. So you've got this succession of individual, big, very fancily illuminated signs.
Fremont Street, which I think is the older bit where it's a bit more like everything's close together.
Which I think is now roofed.
Is it?
I think it's roofed with like a million LEDs, which are used to display NAF like successions of imagery, I think.
Oh my God, that's amazing. Yeah.
Frederick went there a few years ago. He took pictures of the slot machines in the toilets.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, I mean, it's a very bizarre. These gambling centres in general are such an amazing sort of parallel reality. So to return to the strip, what you're experiencing is this big street, which you drive up and down very, very slowly. And then at some distance are these buildings. And then there is this zone in between them, which is occupied by kind of pragmatic needs like parking and access, but also these enormous illuminated, in the classic version, kind of illuminated neon, very ornate signs advertising the various casinos, their sort of branding, their amenities.
Shall we go through the various stages of the casino that he describes? The experience of driving along, particularly at night. Yeah. The difference between day and night is really important because in the day it doesn't work. Or it only works a little bit, whereas at night it's really these illuminated signs.
But once you actually reach those casinos, like there are lots of things inside, but it's an interior world of the casino, yeah, which has all of there's these other bits.
So, I mean, as he describes it, you go up, you park in the front. There's no parking at the back. It's at the front and around the sides of this huge complex. And then there's often what he describes as a sort of piazza at the front, which is like a zone, which might have lots of fountains or something around this huge hotel complex, and the complex might have a tower or not have a tower or something. And then you go in, and then you're in this entirely interior world.
And you go, and this is still true today, you go straight into the casino.
And the casino is, for him, a huge, seemingly sort of endless space where you can't see the walls, you just see lights focusing on the action. So it feels sort of indeterminate in time and space. And it's got a mirror glass, a one-way mirror ceiling, so people can spy, like in Ocean's 11.
The original one. Yeah, so that's one of the things he observes, which is kind of novel and bizarre, is that you go straight into the casino, and then if you actually want to check into the hotel, you sort of have to go off into another room off that, which is the hotel lobby.
Yeah, well, why go to another casino when you've got to go through a casino to get out anyway?
They're sort of things that they do are all a bit better known now, but you know, for instance, there's a rule that they don't have any clocks in there. They remove anything which indicates the passing of time. There's also the thing that when you're in the casino, they give you free drinks as long as you just keep gambling.
Yeah, or free everything to encourage you to stay, I think. It's very exotic. I can see why people would want to get into it as architects, because it's brash and completely understandable at one level. You can totally get it. This is what it's about. And another level, it's exotic and foreign.
Yeah, and it's really designed for kind of binging, isn't it? So we should describe the other parts. So there are other things within the interior world of the casino. You'll have, you know, sort of restaurants and shops and these sorts of things.
Yeah, he doesn't really describe them very much. I think we can just stick to what he describes. He does describe, in the casinos themselves, is he describes the signs at great length and the interaction of the sign and the road and the way the parking works around the building. And then he just sort of says that there's this piazza and then there's this indeterminate space.
Yeah.
And then the interior, in other places he will describe, he describes how motels work. Like, the interiors are sort of tidier than home, fundamentally like home, but with a couple of touches of luxury. And that they exist just in sort of indeterminate grids.
He refers to a bit that he rather fancifully calls the oasis, by which he means the swimming pool, which all of them have.
Yeah, or sort of, yeah, he's got, does a sort of analysis of what's, where the symbols are. He doesn't do it deep, close reading of the signs.
Yeah, I mean, the part which he's really interested in is the level of symbolization or signification that's going on as you're in your open-top car rolling down the strip. What is it that you see and how... What are the principles behind that?
Also, this new sort of public space, which is a public space, uses the Nolli plan of Rome, but to sort of articulate similarities and differences. The Nolli plan of Rome is a plan of Rome from the 18th century?
Yeah, I think so.
Which marks all of the spaces you can walk in, kind of almost accidentally as a public person. So everything that's inaccessible private building is hatched. And everything, everywhere you can walk, is white. So that's the streets, but also the insides of the churches with the church plans and a few other public buildings. So it's a sort of outlining of the public space. And he, with the students, they prepare various plans along that sort of idea for the Las Vegas Strip. But he then describes how the public space is kind of strange because your part of it is this hyperspace of driving, and then a sign, and then you have to go through the gambling hall.
Yeah, you have to have this like modal shift at the door of the casino. You're not moving in the same way from the inside to the space of the outside. The Nolli plan is also one of the modes of representation in this are these more or less sort of silly collages, which are generally about combining some generally very like famous old reference with some little collaged bit of Las Vegas. So he stuck a sort of Las Vegas sign in the middle of the Nolli plan. But equally later, there's a view of the Pantheon, which has...
Yeah, Piranesi's drawing of the Pantheon.
With some of the signs, I guess, from advertising people who
from
are performing.
Caesar's Palace.
Oh, they're the Caesar's Palace signs.
At the bottom of Caesar's Palace.
Which are stuck on, yeah.
But I think that's what he's trying to get about there is the relationship between... Oh, I don't really know what he's banging on about, actually. Because it's sort of... He says all this stuff and he goes on at quite length, kind of describing stuff.
I find it a bit tiresome. I mean, because I think throughout he's doing these historical comparisons, which aren't always all that insightful, and whose purpose is really to show erudition and a certain kind of desacralizing like insouciance towards the heroic past. And it's all like, yeah, 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 we know you teach at Yale and you've studied the history of architecture, thanks very much, I understand, you're very clever, but it doesn't seem like they don't seem to furnish a lot of insight.
There's a lot of student mapping work which has been prepared with a great deal of labor, I'm certain. You know, mapping the level of illumination or various sorts of businesses, like writing out all the signs at scale, all that sort of stuff. Yeah. None of it really amounts to clear communication, though.
They're more or less clear. I think the best drawing is the one you mentioned there, which is a plan of the whole strip, and then it has all of the words, essentially, that you can see from the car. Which are oriented and which are scaled relative to one another. So you get this plan, which is full of these, you know, stardust, Phillips 66, stop, go, stop.
But actually, it looks good as a plan, but I don't think it is like good communication because it's totally unclear to me what scale means on it, for example. So scale isn't the scale of the sign.
I think the scale is relative to, like, they're relative to one another.
But the things written on the road would be much smaller than the massive signs, but much bigger than...
But you could think about it as being like their relative scale within the visual field. I think it works, and I think that I don't know how rigorously it's carried out, but you can certainly imagine it being relatively rigorously sort of approached. Like the stop go, obviously in real terms, those will be small signs, but they'll be quite large if you're pulled up to them. I mean, the other thing which they develop and sort of have a theory of is this relationship between, on the one hand, the observer, and on the other, all of these items which are communicating to you. He wants to make a distinction here between symbols and words, right? When these diagrams where he has W's, those refer to actual words written out, I think, and where they have this funny little sort of CBS blinking eye or whatever it is, that I think is a symbol. Here we could go a little bit into the theory, because they start to try and have this sort of historical perspective on architectural communication in cities through the ages. And there's this comparative diagram which has an Eastern bazaar, a medieval street, main street, commercial strip, the Vegas strip, a shopping centre, and which compares the speed of the observer and then also the way in which and the scale at which signs and symbols are deployed.
Or whether they're deployed. I mean, it's like in absolute basic, I can't find it in the book at the moment, but I can remember it, is that in the bazaar, all you do is show the merchandise. There's no writing, there's no symbols. You just sort of hold it up and say, come buy my wares.
Yeah. So if you're in Marrakesh, it's the conical piles of different spices or whatever on there.
And then he says in the medieval street, there is a sign, but it's mainly just displaying the wares. And then in a high street, the wares are in the window and there's a big sign. And then in a supermarket, there's just a big sign.
Yeah, and the big sign is detached from the building now. So you have the big sign is out by the road. And then you go to this sort of closed, air-conditioned box.
Yeah, via a car park. So you don't even see the building initially properly.
So that the signification has become detached from the, or the symbolization, rather, has become detached from the building itself.
There it's very important for him, and this is something that he describes at various times, that the box that things are put in is low and defined by technology, as he says it. So it's the size that's air-conditioned and
spanned. Yeah, suspended ceiling, air-conditioned, evenly lit. As this starts to go and as it starts to become more theorised, you get this very weird idea that he proposes of what contemporary subjectivity is like, which is sort of that at one point he talks about the cloverleaf junction on a motorway, and this idea that contemporary people are kind of like the car on the cloverleaf junction on the motorway, where you actually want to go left, but you obviously have to merge off to the right. You're just following signs. So the kind of the experience of the contemporary city is that people no longer have any absolute understanding of where they're going. They're just this, you know, weird little space invader following different symbols to fulfill their kind of reward functions.
Bit like playtime.
Playtime.
Yeah. In order to go up, you have to go down, but also a bit like junk space, except that he loves it. He either says you've got to give the people what they want, and what they want is this, or he says it's good.
I think it's good maybe just to talk a bit more about the analysis, because it's much more, there's a lot more, compared with the last book, which communicated almost entirely through reference images. This one is a lot more about drawings and analysis of different kinds. There are a few other things which are layered into this part. One is that there's the polemic against modern architecture, basically, and in favour of what he calls an accommodation with the existing, being kind of attentive to the actually existing city. I have a bit of a frustration with that he uses the terms existing and contemporary in a totally interchangeable way, where there's obviously a problem there, which is that the contemporary isn't equally distributed. And in particular, the strip.
Las Vegas is hyper-specific. Everywhere is not going to become Las Vegas. Las Vegas exists because of a really niche.
Well, to some extent, places did become more like Las Vegas. I mean, I think that Las Vegas was futuristic, and that the conditions of the strip in certain respects permeated into the kind of exurban condition of other American cities. but not in every respect, but I think that there is like a futuristic aspect to it. What he says very specifically is that, you know, modern architects presented their architecture as being kind of rational, the sort of rational expression of pursuing the functional requirements of the program and then satisfying them within a built resolution, whereas in fact it's all about machine worship and the iconography of industrial vernacular.
Well, that's really in part two he's talking about that.
Well, maybe. He says it in part one as well. He like quotes a lot from that Alan Colquhoun essay on typology and design method, and that he says that instead what we ought to be doing is learning from commercial vernacular, so not industrial vernacular but commercial vernacular, and that's sort of the argument which is being made here. But at the same time, I don't know how general the strip is or how much the strip represents, can be seen to represent a condition of the everyday. It's not really, is it?
Although the strip is a real centre of the diagrams, it's not really... He talks as much about petrol stations, which I think are the same in Las Vegas as everywhere else. And these are something which proliferated everywhere. There's a sign. Those signs don't seem to have all the prices on them, which is something which is very central to a petrol station sign now. Yeah, this is the petrol stations are what he divides into: front, side, parts, aerial, oasis, sculpture, and sign. Whereas the Las Vegas Strip has its own. And front is a picture of the front, side is a picture of the side, parts is parts. I mean, they're all sort of obvious. The oasis is like the drinks fridge.
Yeah, there's a bit more of these historical comparisons which he enjoys so much. So he has a bit where he talks about the speed of evolution of these places, the ways like the speed at which the signs. At which the signs change, and he makes this comparison with the Gothic cathedral and the way in which those gradually accrete over time, albeit at a much slower rate. So people joining on chapels to the ambulatory or whatever.
Yeah, the funny thing is the signs kind of evolved between 1940 and maybe like 1990. It's only about twice as fast as the Gothic cathedral.
Yeah. It's not all that fast.
You know, before they got there, like, because I mean, the sort of last edition, it's like a sign with sculpture, a sign with lights, a sign with neons, with moving bits, and then things which are various kind of computer controlled lights, which end up with screens.
I've already said why I think it's annoying, but I thought I would just highlight a couple of other ones. He does what I think he thinks is an extremely amusing analysis of the different architectural styles at work in the Caesar's Palace complex.
Oh, is that the list of all the funny styles? And this bit I can remember thinking, this is just super not for me, this book.
But it's not, but I think it is objectively. I think it's objectively an annoying and pretentious thing to do.
He's analysing the styles in Caesar's Palace. It's also a combination of styles. The front colonnade is San Pietro Bernini in plan, but Yamazaki in vocabulary and scale. The blue-gold mosaic is the early Christian tomb of Galla Placidia. The Baroque symmetry of its prototype precludes an inflection towards the right in the façade. Beyond and above is a slab of Gio Ponti's Pirelli Baroque, and beyond that, in turn, a low wing of neoclassical Motel Moderne. Economics has vanished symmetry in a recent addition, but the new slab and various styles are integrated by the ubiquity of Ed Stone screens. Blah, blah, blah. He compares it to the Villa dell'Est, which is a villa on the outskirts of Rome, I think, which has got a lovely garden. The Piazza of San Pietro is compared to the car park. It's also compared to Bologna's Rape of the Sabine Women, a painting, and the statues of Venus and David also in that city. Bisecting the Venus is an Avis sign, and so on and so on. But it's actually all complete meaning. He has a bit when he's saying that the neon illuminations are the same as the mosaics in the Arab Norman basilicas of Sicily, which are covered all over in, the interior is covered all over in glass mosaic, which as the sun moves sort of glitter and shimmer a little bit. They're really beautiful, they're worth a visit. Because the light changes, and the light's changing on these... But that's completely stupid. they're not like that at all.
There's a good one, like he says that the supermarkets are like Baroque churches because they are, look bigger on the outside than they are on the inside. In the case of the supermarkets, that's because they have this sort of, their front is much taller to create room for a bigger sign. And in the case of the Baroque churches, is because they have a double dome, an inner and an outer dome, the outer of which obviously is much bigger.
To accommodate the structure between them.
That is just totally facile. Like, it doesn't mean, yeah, doesn't mean anything.
My house is like that too, because on the outside it's one wall, but on the inside the wall is subdivided in section into floors.
Yeah. And it's just this like puerile showing off. It's just, yeah. I find it really irritating.
It's sort of different to Complex in Contradiction, where he'll spend a chapter saying that a wall is amazing because it can support things and divides. It can both be a structural support and a divider space.
I don't need to call any more attention to it, but it's an extremely irritating habit, and it's one which has always made me dislike him.
It's funny because it's also got a massive bibliography, this book.
There's an important analogy though before we leave the Gothic cathedral behind entirely, which is that they, as we get to the end of part one, it becomes a bit more propositional, and one of the things that he says is that modern architecture needs to be like a Gothic cathedral without the nave, so that it will be just the chapels, which symbolically are the bits which change. It's not really true, but
almost for him, like the moment of function, which isn't true either.
Yeah, so it doesn't have the big spatially theatrical bit of the extremely high dramatic middle. It has the circulation space of the aisles and ambulatory, and it has the sort of changeable plugins of the chapels.
Yeah, he sort of suggests that cathedrals are tall because if you want something big, height is cheap in the Middle Ages, whereas if you want something impressive, you want it big in the Middle Ages, so you make it tall. Whereas if you want something impressive now, you air condition it and you make it low.
I think that there are parts in this which are really quite out there. And in a way, I kind of, the bits of this book which I enjoy most, where he pushes into, is almost kind of proto-cyberpunk kind of description of buildings where the walls are indiscernible, where all you have is all of these signs on the darkened interior, where the big low space.
The bit that's most interesting is definitely Las Vegas itself.
When he imagines it's like he's imagining the most condensed, intensified version of Las Vegas. He wants to have communication without what he calls monumentality, or even he calls space. Like, architects should stop thinking about space.
A lot of these things are really gone over in part two in a more clear. He kind of says them at the beginning, and you're like, I was just reading it and thinking,
that doesn't really make any sense.
Well, with this thing, I was thinking, part one, I was interested in what it's like Las Vegas, because it's really cool. It's sort of images, and all I have from it are images. And it is something that lots of people have been drawn to as a source of images, Las Vegas at that time, as people I'm sure were drawn to, you know. And then he's got all this analysis, and a lot of the analysis is, most of it's not that, like, fancy, you know. It's not as fancy as comparing all these things to all these buildings in Europe that he's seen. Most of it is kind of inane. It's like inanely saying the car park is here for this reason, and I'm just sort of like, fine. And then there are bits which are good, which is where he's getting into like these spaces, and I could have done with a bit more of that.
So he talks about the vitality of inclusion, which is something he makes a case for, which I think the inclusion is really, you know, as much communication, as many signs as possible in this darkened, spaceless, low interior, where I think I kind of imagine, when I imagine people experiencing it, they sort of are experiencing it as pure id or something, aren't they? They're like just these little desire engines going from one brightly lit little moth.
It's funny because it reminded me of Bruno Taut, actually. It reminded me of the Crystal Paradise.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely people in a particularly kind of heightened and totally uncomplicated state.
Like all of his kaleidoscopic twirling light show things available at the touch of a button in Universal Space. He's just really, but it's just cars, right? The rest of it's just cars.
He has a piece of terminology, which I don't know if we want to talk about. So they have an analysis of the stardust sign, which is that the lower bit is information, actually saying what's on, what you get, what the prices are, this kind of thing. And then the top bit is what they call heraldry. So applied imagery, symbol, logo to identify at long distance. There's another dimension of heraldry, which is as a term to appropriate, which is that they're interested in, and they sort of believe that these symbols which you use in these communications have a sort of essential cultural foundation, so that they're things which are long established through tradition. And when they come on to, you know, how you would propose an architecture which learns from Las Vegas, like the heraldic kind of codex of things, symbols which mean things, is really important. And so, you know, obviously in heraldry, if you think of coats of arms, that's what they're alluding to, the fact that you have, you know, a lion in this way and it means this, or you have this this plant and it connotes this or whatever.
Yeah, it's much more like the heraldry of like business school in London, where the shield has got like a mouse, like a pound sign,
only
a computer, and like and a mortise board, like that. It's much more like, it's not hidden symbolism. Well, but I guess what I was, apart from making a joke, what I was trying to get to with that was that the messages that he's talking about, like in heraldry, you don't have to understand the symbols, you just have to recognize it, really. Yeah. Like the purpose. Whereas for him, like different aspects of it are kind of communicating luxury, and the model of ancient Rome is decadent, transgressive pleasure. Yeah. Decadence before collapse. You know, he talks a lot about Caesar's palace. He kind of pulls his punches, doesn't he? You're never quite sure how, like whether he quite is going for something or not. He sort of talks around the subject, but he's not willing to say this is like subconsciously communicating something, and he's not willing to say these are deep cultural things. I mean, the Stardust sign is really like stars. It's illuminated stars. They're all like clustered together, like they were coming out like a mist at the top with Stardust written across it. And then there's a couple going down the sign, sort of like it was a firework and they were falling sparks. And then at the bottom of the sign, there's like a couple of billboards which say, you know,
Engelbert Humperdinck.
Fangle Valley, yeah. Such a funny name to choose, isn't it? Like this extraordinarily C-grade mid-19th century operetta composer. Kept the Beatles off the number one slot. I can't remember which. Like one of their really major singles was kept off by Please Release Me.
Yeah, very good.
The truth of the swinging 60s.
There was one, this is just an observation in passing, but I think that it's interesting for how it locates Venturi vis-a-vis the struggle against modernist planning. There's a point where the recent demolition of Penn Station in New York is brought up, and he very pointedly refuses to like mourn it.
He's kind of pro-demolition.
Yeah, he says, well, it was kind of a waste of space, we don't need that kind of monumentality
anymore.
Yeah,
it should all be low now. Everything should be like subway stations, he says.
For those who don't know, is like one of the famous architectural crimes of the century, really. I mean, we'll get more into that. I think we'll have more relevance for our discussion of God's Own Junkyard, which is what we're going to talk about in the bonus. Both of these, both Venturi's Complexity and Contradiction and this later Learning from Las Vegas, very pointedly,
they criticise and take images from this book. It's in fact the source of the famous duck, which we're going to get onto in a sec.
Yeah. So that'll be in the bonus, which you will have access to if you subscribe on Patreon. So we're going to take advantage of the break between part one and part two to tell you about our sponsor, which is The Great Courses Plus. It is a streaming learning service. What will you find on there? You will find videos of lectures.
Not only videos, also useful materials to go with them, but the videos is the core.
Yeah, let's say you're like us and you love to learn.
Thirst for knowledge.
You want to go on learning. And let's say that this isn't something which you studied at university, but it's something which you're interested in acquiring like a broader kind of context for, like a more systematic understanding of.
Well, let's say you even did study at university and you want to know some more.
Well, The Great Courses Plus may well be what you're looking for.
Yeah. A myriad of subjects.
Yeah. So we've got history, literature, engineering, art, cooking, photography, and they are, unlike this podcast, all presented by experts.
Yeah, people who know what they're talking about. And the content's been written properly.
We've been watching a particular course on there, which is Understanding the World's Greatest Structures.
Yeah, am I going to say another thing about it this time?
Yeah,
say something else. We've been through that it goes through the different types of structures. And yeah. We said it goes through different types of materials.
Yes.
And we said it goes through great buildings.
Yes.
And we said it uses fantastic models.
Yes.
And it's presented in an amusing and culturally aware kind of way.
Yes.
Oh, I'll probably do. It was pretty good, actually, that lecture series.
It sort of goes through like systematic. If you've kind of heard of, you know, terms like tension, compression, shear, these sorts of terms of art which refer to particular moments, these things which refer to particular concerns within the engineering and design of buildings, but you would like to know specifically what they are,
and also not just. Like, it's very easy to find out what shear means, but what does that mean in the context of a masonry tension reinforced structure?
Yeah.
How do you apply it? Where is that important? And I think if you went through all of them, you'd really get a sense of, like, there aren't that many ways most buildings are put together. You really can, in the course of a lecture series like that, get an idea of the basics of how nearly all buildings stand up.
Yeah, and also how all of those different sorts of principles or sorts of engineerings necessarily interrelate in the way that different elements go together.
It's no good if the building's really good at everything except if you push it in one direction, it falls over. That's considered a bit of a failure.
Yeah. Yeah, so if that sounds interesting, there's something even better, which is that we've got a special time-limited offer, an entire month, entirely free. But if you want to access that, you need to sign up through our special URL. Do you remember what it is?
No. Well, I'm sure, I expect it's thegreatcoursesplus/buildings.
.com/buildings. Thegreatcoursesplus.
That's why. That's why it's helpful to have it written down in front of you, which I do not have.
Thegreatcoursesplus.com/buildings. That is
thegreatcoursesplus.com/buildings.
And they'll know that you came from us. Thanks.
Before we talk about part two, which we're going to do in a sec, more than usual, I had to sort of struggle to make much comment on this, because when I was reading it, I was, this book is not for me. I was finding it a bit boring. Part one, this book is super popular. Part one is less popular than part two, but I think it would have been much, much more interesting at the time, because it would have been transgressive and describing something new, whereas now this is being completely absorbed into the mainstream. So the sort of shock of the new of it's been absorbed. Also, it's not unusual for architects to think about all sorts of different buildings. And I think another reason that the, like, making these, like, outrageous comparisons is less interesting is, in a way, like, if you think of, like, the comedy of the time, like Beyond the Fringe or something, just the transgression was really funny. Because it was kind of a buttoned-up world, like just imitating the Prime Minister in a stupid way or something. The hegemonic modernism, which really did exist, we didn't live through it, and it turns out it was a massive historical exception. Through architectural history, it hasn't been like that. There's been this presiding theory everywhere. I mean, at no point did everyone agree with it, lots and lots of people, but it was a house, kind of universal house style of government. In a way that you can't imagine anything being now, really. I mean, a lot of the power of part one, this, like, exoticism, but it's not that exotic for us anymore, this transgression, but it's not transgressive anymore, this cleverness, which is another form of transgression, like the cleverness of saying a motel sign is the same as a Brunelleschi, when they're different, like... Sure, they can be, like, both can be using the fact that they're shiny. I mean, what basically the thing that's in common with the mosaic cathedral and the sign is they're both shiny.
Yeah.
There's a touch more to it than that, but really that's the key message. This, like other things, is shiny. So all of that falls flat, and I was just like, yeah.
A lot of diagrams. Yeah, I have a fondness for the drawing with all the words on. I think it's nice. But the others, I'm not pretty sceptical about.
But also, I guess, I don't own a car. I live in a city where I live, we walk everywhere. And when we don't walk, we cycle or take the tube. I get into a car, like, on a monthly basis. And it's an Uber, probably. It's super undrivable round here.
No, we're extremely eccentric. I saw a map of the UK by local government area showing places where more people don't use cars to commute than do. And there are something like 5 places in the whole UK where that's true. Yeah. So there's a bit of London, obviously.
Yeah, around here. Like, quite, but I mean, a bit of London that like 3 million people
there
live
is
in or something.
Central Oxford, central Cambridge.
Yeah, yeah.
Edinburgh.
Yeah.
Glasgow. That's it. There's some places are close, like Manchester. It's sort of close. I was a bit surprised by Glasgow, which has got like, there's definitely sort of very much still in the heroic age of the car, but a lot of people must be commuting by other means.
The centre's quite high density though, which is quite nice.
So we should talk about part two, which is...
This was more interesting to read, particularly as it gets on towards the end. The beginning has got more of his cleverness.
Yeah. Well, it starts early on. It has this very famous...
It's called, by the way, Ugly and Ordinary.
Ugly and Ordinary. Well, we'll get onto Ugly and Ordinary in a second. I think before that, we should talk about the duck and the decorated shed, which are actually the first thing which they discuss, and which are by far... If you know one thing about this book, you know about that. And I think it's a really brilliant analogical condensation of the thinking in this book into a really, really like simple, easy to remember comparison.
Yeah, let's just say what it is. This is the key, you know, like Rossi has his monuments and districts. Corp has like the machine age.
Yeah. So the duck, which is a sort of funny idea. This, as with so much in these books, is draws on Venturi's response to Peter Blake's God's Own Junkyard. One of the photos within which is of this, is it like a bait and tackle shop?
I don't know what it is. He says it's a drive through something.
I think it's like a roadside shop near a pond, near like a lake. And it's shaped like a duck.
Like I really wanted to be selling like duck sticks.
Duck sticks.
Like duck on a stick duck, or something.
Yeah, dried
or like
duck. Yeah, duck jerky.
No, something juicy. Like duck sandwich. Like sort of like shredded duck sandwich.
Oh, that would be nice, yeah. It's very cute. It looks
it's a white rendered
the proportions
it's
are
a white
a little
rendered
bit off.
Duck with like seemingly no apertures, just one door.
There's a big
which
door,
is
yeah.
Right at the front of the duck.
It's very cool.
But the duck is not a typical duck, is it?
No, but so what is a duck? A duck is a building which is a symbol of itself.
Yeah, a duck is a building where the form of the building is symbolic.
So the way that the building communicates is through being a thing with certain qualities, yeah, which looks a certain way. And the comparison is the decorated shed, which is like the casino or all of these supermarkets, a generic box which has as a kind of separate layer these means of communication, these signs, which may be literally applied to the building or may also be distant from it.
Yeah, and he says, and he gives some historic examples, he says Chartres is a duck and a decorated shed.
Right.
Because it's got applied decoration and the shape is symbolic. He says the Villa Farnese is just a decorated shed.
Mm-hmm.
And he says this tiny cathedral in Athens is just a duck. Because it's really small.
And Ronchamp, Corbusier's church, that's a duck.
That's a duck.
Classic duck.
He thinks essentially all modernist buildings tend towards duckiness.
Yeah. Duckism.
Except for high-rise office buildings. Like, if there's anything sort of really structured, if there's anything in the plan that's been done to be expressive, it's a duck.
Yeah.
But it can be both at once.
It's sort of difficult, though, because he is also against purism, isn't he? He's against buildings which are too pure, modernistically pure.
He's against minimalism.
Yeah.
Because he thinks minimalism... He's against minimalism where it's a design intention.
Yeah, so you can't have the undecorated shed, which is this sort of third unmentioned category, which would be the
Well, he says you kind of can, but it's got to be like an... It's got to literally be an aircraft hangar.
Yeah, the like modernistically undecorated, like generic building, yeah, which expresses itself as sort of pure volumes.
He attacks that on two lines. And he attacks it by saying it's a duck. He says that the pure box,
yeah,
block...
It's just another kind of duck.
It's another kind of duck because he doesn't actually talk about like housing blocks. He talks about meese.
Yeah.
And meese is a real extreme where it's like this immaculate, like everything is finished like a BMW,
yeah,
in meese. And the first thing he attacks is that his steel is fireproofed. So it's a steel that's fireproofed with a metal fascia.
Yeah. Well, in the high rises it is, yeah.
But that's all he talks about, right? So it's not real, but they put more work in it to make it look like that.
Yeah.
So he says that's wrong. And he says, so less is more work. Trying to recreate slightly the effect of less is bore that he'd put in Complexity and Contradiction. And what was his other line of attack? His other line of attack is, even stripping things out is like symbolic.
Yeah.
And he says that ducks are not really interesting.
Yeah, he has lots of different arguments. He has one which is that they are a waste of money.
Don't give people what they want.
Yeah, this is not the time for heroic communication through pure architecture. So he has a sort of argument from, you know, what the present moment demands or the complexity of the present moment. And
there's a really key one which is that he sort of recapitulates all the way through kind of both parts, but which is that they are heroically celebrating 100-year-old technology. They're heroically celebrating industrial technology, and we should be heroically celebrating electronics.
And I think we've said this already, but the idea that he has is that this is the architecture which we need is one for the information age rather than for the industrial one that celebrates the industrial age. So, and that is one which is going to be communicative.
Yeah, can I point out a problem with this? If a building is going to express its making, and its making is industrial. Well, if a building's going to express its making, it can either be like vernacular or industrial. Because buildings aren't made of information, they're made of materials. And the Industrial Revolution is the materials revolution. You can't build a building out of a computer. It won't keep the rain out. His solution to this is everything should have electronic signs outside it.
Yeah.
Well, and should be air-conditioned. But the fabric of the building... The envelope of the building is made of physical stuff. Stuff that is materials, which is industrially produced. It doesn't have to be industrially produced. It could be, like, hand-produced. Yeah. Those are sort of the options. It's normally some amalgamation. Like, whatever you do, the skin of a building is going to have some amalgamation of natural things, yeah, ruggedy handmade-y things, or industrially things. And they're different kind of industrial aesthetics, but that's kind of all you can do. Like, you can clad it in wood, render, bricks, metal, glass,
or
some other thing.
Paper. Yeah.
Paper, thatch. Yeah. The, like, delightful complexity contradiction of the information age is like Reddit.
Mm.
It's 4chan. It's not...
It's not turbine halls.
It's not turbine halls. It's not a building. It's, like, on the internet. Or... In his time, and still there, you know, like fantastic illuminated signs.
Yeah, should we go on, so that we could go on to the comparison, because I think that that might bring out some more of this a bit. Because the thing which they go into is this comparison between what he calls the heroic and original versus the ugly and ordinary. And this is a comparison between a building of Venturian Rauch, as then was, and a building by... Paul Rudolph, who's a sort of celebrated post-war American architect, probably like the greatest sort of stylist of the post-war.
Can I say something? Like, a lot of our audience are interested in architectural theory. Architectural theory episodes are really popular. If you're thinking of writing as an architect, an architectural book of architectural theory, think long and hard before you use as comparison one of your own buildings versus someone else, because there's almost no way of doing it without looking like a dick.
Yeah.
He doesn't particularly pass. You can just think through the permutations of this. Either you compare it to a great building, in which case you're saying I'm like a great person, which, even if you believe it to be true, will make yourself look stupid, or various other alternatives which also make yourself look stupid, and it just doesn't come over well. You're much better to stick off being a, you know, like Rem or Pugin. Like, have a strong agenda, but compare other people's things. Or if you're going to get into the business of comparing buildings at all, which is possibly suspect, but fine.
Yeah, I mean, the comparative method, which is a phrase taken from Bannister Fletcher in the late 19th century, is one which they use specifically in this book as what they're doing. Although there's also this this added element of psychodrama, which is that Rudolph, I think, built the architecture department at Yale, where this thing was being taught, which is this extremely cool building, but not totally beloved by staff, I think, or at least not at the time.
Architecture school, not beloved by staff. As opposed to 100% of them.
So the comparison that he makes, there's this spread where on the left there's the Rudolph, on the right there's the Venturi and Rauch building. So on the left, Crawford Manor. I think they're both old people's homes. And they're both sort of a similar thing where you have...
What do we call this? This category we call... They're like service departments.
Service departments, yeah. Yeah, so they're like individual, little individual one-bed flats.
Both about 90 units.
So Crawford Manor is like a high... It's high-rise... And like all these Rudolph buildings, it very dramatically articulates these different forms which are kind of making it up, so that you have these dramatic vertical forms which are sort of bundled together, these kind of rectilinear forms. And then protruding out of it, you have these expressed balconies which are slightly curved.
Each flat is like a bedroom with a ensuite, living dining room with a kitchenette off it. And they're sort of tessellated. These blocks are tessellated round, which produces this interesting outline, which is then extruded up. It's quite straightforwardly brutalist, I would say. Imagine a brutalist medium high rise. It's like that. Very articulated facade.
Yeah. Is it concrete facade as well? It's got this kind of striped concrete, I think.
Yeah.
I think sort of pinstripe concrete.
I think it might be, from reading Venturi, it might be like rendered with like, you know, sort of rendered cinder block. Infill with a concrete frame.
And Guildhouse, we described before, did we describe it on the bonus or did we do it on the, can't remember, I think we might have done it on the bonus. So
yeah, it's we didn't like it all that much.
No, it's a sort of 5 or 6 story brick, feels quite kind of low and wide. The windows are relatively small. Some of the windows which he's into are these ones he calls double hung, which are sort of sash windows, but which read as like a big, like, child's window. The heroic in original is Rudolph, and the ordinary and ugly in this kind of faux humble way is the Venturi building.
He doesn't keep the humble up very long.
No, he doesn't get it up at all. I mean, God, yeah. There's something which he wants to say about the way these buildings communicate, which is that the Rudolph one, the meanings or the whatever, the significations that it expresses are expressed through connotation. They are things which gesture towards meaning rather than embodying it.
He sort of reads it as like being lots of industrial. The bit at the side, which is all the kitchenettes, he says it's like some ducts or something. But actually it's just kitchens.
Yeah, it's kind of metaphoric.
He's got a thing about it being... Yeah. He says it's metaphoric, but he also keeps saying, and I think you've got to say this, he keeps taking the piss out of it and undermining it for being hypocritical.
Yeah.
He says at the beginning... Don't think I'm picky on this because I don't like it. I think it's good. And then he just mocks it continuously.
And then in his one, he says that his one communicates through denotation, which I think is completely suspect. I don't think that means what he thinks it does.
I think he's made up a term of art. It's fine. People do that all the time.
But it literally, denotation, something denotes something when that's literally the established meaning that it has. So
Whereas a sculpture made of things that look like... TV antennas, he says, denotes old people.
It doesn't denote old people. That's connotation again.
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, like, it barely reads old people at all.
The sign on the front, Guild House, literally denotes Guild House. Yeah, that's sort of how language works.
Anyway, he thinks his is much better.
This is where he brings in the argument from that Alan Colquhoun essay, which is about modernist industrial worship and all that, and that quite a lot of that comes in.
He keeps banging on that his is better because three things. One, it's cheaper.
Yeah. That has some virtue, yeah.
It's like, well, yeah, okay, yeah. Two, That was going to be my three. Two, it's decorated with symbols. It's got a sign at the front that says what it is. It's got this sculpture on the roof, which is a sculpture of TV antennas, which he sort of suggests is the real TV antenna and is not hiding the TV antenna, but actually is hiding the TV antenna, which is right behind it, hidden in exactly the way that he says it's not. You can see it in the photos. And then the third reason is it's like homely because it doesn't challenge people.
Yeah.
The windows look like windows. And I think that, you know, you can go along with that, except that it's not homely. It's like an obvious, like, it looks like a less interesting 60s concrete block.
Well, it looks institutional because, and in part this is because of things which he's very consciously chosen to do. He's chosen to make it symmetrical, to give it this somewhat neoclassical, though very, very abstracted version of that massing. And it gives it a very, very institutional appearance. And also then he's put in these like windows which to me look like prison windows, these little high up strip. I mean, I find that we already went through on the bonus how much I dislike this building, but it looks very, very gloomy and unpleasant to me.
It could some unpleasant institution, a borstal or madhouse or something,
if that's the vibe you want to go for in the place that you're depositing your elderly relatives. I think that's cool. So, I mean, I think I would make it, obviously, yeah, the Rudolph building is using these industrial symbols, but the meaning which it's quite consciously, I think, trying to connote is being futuristic. Yeah, I think the heroism is part of it, isn't it? It's trying to be sort of new, futuristic, exciting looking, producing interesting kind of play of light and shade.
We emphasize one thing in the old categories, which is that he thinks is really important, which he thinks it's really important that his building, unlike others, can accommodate inhabitation, can accommodate people hanging out there washing. He specifically has a thing where he talks for a while about the plastic flowers that people put in the windows, and his building can accommodate that, and modernism can't. And as far as I'm concerned, he provides no convincing lines of argument for that at all, but it's something that's important for him.
Yeah, if you were to go to Alexandra Road, which is a housing development in London of a sort of similarly heroic modernist like expressiveness, the way that people inhabit it is a very sort of successful part of its effect. But also, I mean, he has a critique that, well, you wouldn't know what this building is because it's just it's a brutalist big building, but then you don't particularly need to know what it is, do you?
You obviously know what it is. It's got all these balconies with people's potted plants on them.
Yeah, I mean, obviously
it's
people...
It's a block of flats. It's a block of flats. Everyone's got their own balcony. Everyone's got their own little garden in the sky. You can see into everyone's living room. I mean, it's all there.
If your granny lives there, you're going to know what's in there, aren't you?
The thing is, these buildings have been around for so long that they almost, like, if you grew up in cities, they almost connotate cozy.
Yeah. The other thing which starts to come in here is that he has this case which he wants to make against space, which he calls a sort of tyrannical fixation in architecture, the fixation on creating space and on thinking spatially being what you know, how architects should give meaning to their architecture. I think the way he uses this idea of like space, which I think is to some extent is a carryover of the case against expressionism that he was making in Complexity and Contradiction, is a bit confusing. One of the things which I think needs to be a part of the way in which you think about space is, you know, how do plans work? And looking at the comparison between the plan of Rudolph's building and the plan of his building, something you see very clearly in Rudolph's building is that when you come out of the lift, there is a big window which admits light directly into the hall which you're walking into, and that this series of different, you know, the way in this like clustering effect that in the plan of the different flats means that they receive light from different orientations, and those are two results of the space planning, the spatial layout of the plan, which are not the case in Venturi's building.
Rudolph 1 is undeniably better to live in, if you look at the plans. And I mean, there's a couple of reasons for that, which are just... There's one thing that's the fault of Venturi, but there's two things that aren't, which are basically the same one, which is that it's a higher budget thing in a tighter site. So it's taller, which means each floor is smaller, less deep, which means you can let more light in. And it's got what is a bit more expensive... a wibbly wobbly edge, which gives it more like surface area to volume, which means you can bring light into everywhere. So you've got this lovely lit, you come out of the lift, and not only is it lit, you've got a great view on each floor, you see the city laid out.
Yeah, it's very exciting.
Whereas Venturi's, the bathroom and the kitchen have no light and air, they're deep in the plan, the corridor has no windows or ventilation of any kind, so it's less nice. Now, it's lower, it's also cheaper. I mean, they can just be constraints of the budget.
Yeah.
It's fair. Fine.
Fair enough, but...
But that's not what he's saying.
Yeah.
He's saying that somehow that gives people what they want in a way that the Brutalist doesn't. Whereas actually, if you were selling these in London, you'd get much more money for the Brutalist one.
Yeah, because they look really good.
You'd be able to sell them more easily.
They'd be a lot more fun. It'd be a great place to have people over to.
Yeah, they're kind of like Barbican ones, but they're more fruity. I mean, they're all tiny, these flats. They're both tiny, and they're both about the they've both got about the same area.
I guess the thing is that ultimately you get to this justification, which is like, well, these are flats for people who just watch TV all day because they're very old, which is you know, fine, but it's not a great deal to celebrate in that. It's like, oh, well, their surroundings don't need...
That's so desperately, like, nihilistic.
It is, yeah, it is. It is. It ends up at quite a sort of nihilistic place, that line of thought, I think.
And I don't think it's true or helpful, that. I think that is more than nihilistic. It's like misanthropic.
Yeah.
It's actively misanthropic. It's just not...
Okay, so I want to read this because I think that this is an important... There are these, like, little, quite short... Their chapters are like a paragraph long often, these bits here. So he has one called Space as God. So he says, perhaps the most tyrannical element in our architecture now is space. Space has been contrived by architects and deified by critics, filling the vacuum created by fugitive symbolism. If articulation has taken over from ornament in the architecture of abstract expressionism, space is what displaced symbolism. Our heroic and original symbols from Carcieri to Cape Kennedy feed our late romantic egos and satisfy our lust for expressionistic acrobatic space for a new age in architecture. It's space and light. Light as an element for distorting space for further dramatization. Today, however, most buildings need windows to look out of rather than glass walls for light, because our lighting standards are higher than can be satisfied through daylight alone, and areas of glass must be kept small and ceilings reasonably low to contain the air conditioning and meet the budget. Therefore, our aesthetic impact should come from sources other than light, more symbolic and less spatial sources. This is, like, really very polemical, and for me, it's something which was latent all the way through Complexity and Contradiction, actually, this kind of anti-spatial way of looking at architecture.
It's bizarre, isn't it? Do you think he actually likes this? Do you think he actually believes this?
I don't think he can. No, I don't think he can. Like, the spatial quality
you can have both.
Of rooms
doesn't matter.
It's
not space or symbolism. Symbolism, as I'm sure I've ranted on about anyway, or, like, meaning, you can't get rid of it.
Yeah.
You can't, it's always there. Whatever you do, you can't get rid of meaning. And then space, you can't get rid of space either.
What is an architecture of non-space? It's really weird. Also, if you look at the buildings, you see that they clearly have, you know, Venturi Scott Brown's buildings have, they do have spatial ideas. And often they have spatial ideas which they go back to more than once.
He's quite good at light and windows as well. He's good at window arranging. And he's quite good at light.
I think that this is just completely sort of puerile iconoclasm, really, because he's just saying, well, I don't care about space, because he knows that's the thing which, quote unquote, modern architecture cares most about. So he's trying to be a kind of old.
There is something about it which is super offensive, which is that for a long time now, commercial developers have been saying, we give people what they want, and what they want is tiny rooms, dark, horrible space standards, and tiny flats. And that's what they want, and that's what we're going to give them. And we just don't believe that. I would hope I could say for both of us, we don't believe that's true.
No, it's not.
We think people want nice buildings with light and decent space standards.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that discourse has got so far that it's got to the point where occasionally politicians will talk about it. And he's basically going, no,
yeah,
it's not a matter of architecture, it's not a matter of space, it's just a matter of pragmatic commercialism.
Yeah, and the right
and cynicism.
The right symbols as well. I mean, I think that the other dimension of this, which is very peculiar when you really think about it, is what does he mean by symbolism? What's this act of symbolizing, which he thinks should be going on all the time? Is it that the primary duty of architects is to do a kind of continuous propaganda on behalf of the actually existing economic order, or what? Like, or is are we doing entertainment? What is that symbolization which is meant to be going on?
Because as I said, like, you can't avoid the symbols
finding?
Will always creep in. Like, if you live in, like, what looks like a house varies culture to culture, but people will always read things symbolically. Like, in a way, the Brutalist building can kind of seem quite homely to us because we've, well, old people live in because they've lived in them for so long, and you go around and they've all got their pot plants and you sort of associate them with like that period with like granny and like like flock wallpaper. Yeah. Also, you know, the places of home. So the symbolism's always there. Yeah, what does he just mean we should put signs on everything?
Loads of signs. But then you run into this other problem, which is one, it's all about kind of temporality. You know, like, architecture is just on the wrong sort of time scale. It can't compete with television or advertising because it's much slower.
It's also complete nonsense that, like, there is something which is true, which is that the word and way of talking about something called space is quite a late invention. People don't talk... And architects talk about space all the time in a kind of way that I can imagine could get your goat. Like,
it is a bit obfuscatory.
It's a bit
yeah.
of a sort of bullshit bingo word. But people always wanted it. Like, Gothic cathedral, you can't say a Gothic cathedral is about symbolism. Or churches, like, where people have traditionally, or religious buildings in general, where people have traditionally, like, lavished lots of care, are very spatial. Now, there are all sorts of different sorts of spaces, and they'll also be very symbolic. But the symbols change everywhere. But the things that people like in space are kind of more constant.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the other thing which I was just going to say is that space acts on you in a different way from symbolism. So the qualities of, you know, light and shade, the space kind of above or around you, these act on you in a way which happens whether or not you are consciously paying attention to them. So it's not the same. There's a difference between the way a space feels and looking at an advert and seeing it's for, you know, silk cut cigarettes or whatever.
Sure.
Like, those are not the same.
I think there are things
register.
That, like, the way space feels is affected by culture a bit. Like, if you think, in general, the religious buildings of hot, bright countries don't have big windows.
Mm.
And they quite like it kind of dark.
Mm.
Compared to in the north, we like it really bright. I don't think you'd have done Gothic in the Sahara. It wouldn't have made sense. But I think as well as that, like, physical condition, I think there are cultural effects. Where different things can be desirable in different places a bit, but it's definitely more real because it's real. Architecture's real. Like, it's very cultural as well, but it's real. It's not.
Yeah, I mean, we are sort of moving. How much more do you want to talk about?
Well,
here?
He's got an analysis of what drives modernism, which is between those two things. So he goes through which he regards something that he really focuses on. Is that architecture is driven by, he thinks, or like there's something that's incredible, which is looking at a model and then trying to replicate that in some way. And historic buildings are kind of an iteration of repetition, an evolution. And that the modernists have broken this by, for some reason, he thinks, and he doesn't understand really why, they've been attracted to various things, the backs of train sheds, ocean liners and whatever, and that has caused them to build in a particular way. So he goes first through, like, Gropius. He's got a thing on towards a new architecture, his criticism of which he calls towards an old architecture, in which he says, like, Corbusier uses old models and new models, but he only really takes from the new models. You know, this thing is like a grain elevator, this thing is like a whatever. It's one of the more interesting bits to read. I didn't mind reading it, but I had this strong sense that he's got a misapprehension. I don't think architecture does just come from, like, copying models. Actually. I think like, it's a bit like that for real reasons. There's a little bit after that where he says, you know, the modernists were complaining about these eclectic Victorians, but they're way more eclectic. Modernist buildings copy Kew Gardens sheds, industrial buildings of the Midlands.
Yeah, well, this is all
these
this is
ocean
all from...
liners, cars. Yeah. I'm not sure that's really what's going on, actually. Modernists can like those things, and they can produce things that are like those things, but that can be for reasons other than they're just copying them.
Yeah, so this is all from the Alan Colquhoun essay, basically. The argument which it makes is essentially trying to dethrone the notion of a kind of rational architecture. So an architecture which progresses logically from an identification of functional requirements to a sort of formal resolution of those requirements in spatial form. And what it's saying is that if you really examine modernism, actually what they do is to draw on lots of either symbolic or other types, which are these things which people are copying. I guess that he read that essay and really liked it, but he essentially extemporizes on that theme for quite a long time.
There's a big recapitulation of that, if that's what... I haven't read the original essay. My problem with it is, sure, it does work on types, but types are not purely cultural objects.
Yeah. No, the thing with which in Colquhoun's essay, what he's trying to do is to say, this is a dimension of modernist design practice which people have turned a blind eye to, which I think is true.
Yeah, I've got a problem with
whereas,
that.
But I think it's also true to say that's not the only thing that's going on.
And also the way Venturi talks about it, he talks about it as if these types are just cultural objects, whereas actually types of buildings are interactions of what a culture wants and remembers with physical requirements, with material properties, with construction methods. That's kind of what comes together to build a type. And those conditions will mean that some things will be similar, like it's a bit culture and it's a bit like evolution, where in fact it's exactly like evolution. If you come up with the same solution several times, partly because you've got the machinery for it already, but mm-hmm. partly because it works. Partly because it is also a real thing out there. And he just seems to neglect that. And I feel a bit like that with the duck in the decorated shed. Like, I feel that it is a way you can look at things. You can say, you know, if you invent a category, you can kind of compare, put lots of things into it. You can go, oh, is this... I mean, this is something that's been generally true to a lesser or greater extent with all the theory books we've looked at, which is that they'll look at a place, generate a rule from that place or phenomenon, and then try and apply it everywhere, like Rossi in his sort of northern Italy or, you know... But this seems particularly true. I don't think this way of looking at things is really very useful for understanding what buildings are about very much at all.
No, I think it's strange that one of the things which is being posited, although not said explicitly, is that basically the semiotic analysis and the critique of style are the primary way in which we should investigate architecture's like function, like its purpose. Whereas to me, they are like far from the most interesting or important thing about buildings.
Yeah, but I mean, it's weird how central that is. Like, it doesn't seem any more useful to me. It's like at the same level useful as Ruskin saying all columns are Doric or Corinthian, and what determines this is whether the top is concave or convex, and that's all columns. That's not very useful. That's possible. That's a way of you could look at things. It's not very useful. Venturi's ducks and decoration sheds is possibly a little bit more useful. I haven't really had any... I've thought about lots of buildings and what they could be in that context. I haven't really gleaned any useful information from thinking like that.
No.
I may do in the future. I don't know. If I do, I'll say.
Well, because it's difficult to think of any which are not spatial on one hand or do not have some kind of...
Yeah, they're all a bit of both.
Like, non-essential symbolism, instantiated in them somewhere.
It's a false division.
Yeah, it's completely false.
And it also, like, understanding buildings as carriers of symbols, and that being the main way of categorising them, is just weird.
Yeah, it's super weird. It's a super weird way of thinking about the world. And it then fundamentally makes it also means that, well, that's the whole way in which we need to understand the kind of contested space of the city is this sort of communicative space rather than one which is well, whether it's like power or infrastructure or access or movement or amenity, you know, all of these other things which seem to be like profoundly more important.
And then there's a problem, which is that his buildings aren't that good.
No, they're not, sorry.
They're not that interesting.
They're not.
I may be surprised. Sometimes I go to buildings I think are not good, and I go to them, and it turns out they're good.
Mm.
And he is good at arranging rectangles, and he's good at some of the... Like, I think the fire station, he does another comparison as well as the old people's home comparison of two fire stations, one by him, which he says is brilliant, and one by someone else, which he says is rubbish. Although he's perpetually saying, I don't think this is rubbish. It's just useless and contradictory and a waste of resources and pointless. And mine is honest and true and brilliant. But I think they're both good
The fire station is nice.
But the fire station is good. And he's very obviously very clever. He's very good at some specific areas of the business of architecture. Although he seems to like resist what he's good at, which is like... He's quite good at arranging space, and he's very good at arranging proportions in elevation and making things look certain.
There are some nice facades. The fire station, just to describe it, to some extent repeats the trick of the mother's house, you know, in that it's got these different types of windows arranged across a quite linear facade.
Like one of each type
facade,
of opening.
One of each kind. And it's got a big tower in the middle, actually, which is like the big chimney. But then it's brick, but then it has a painted part on it, which reads like quite kind of dynamically and asymmetrically because of the different sizes of the different openings. From the side or from a kind of diagonal view, it looks a bit like something from Russia in the 1920s, you know, these kind of suprematist compositions of big graphical forms intersecting with one another. An impression which is kind of reinforced by the enormous superscript graphic which is on top of the tower.
So it's Fire Station 4,
which is exactly the sort of thing which someone would have in a Russian revolutionary building.
Yeah, he loves the double statement. He loves it to the building to say fire station, and then it's to say fire station on top, which is funny, isn't it? Like, he doesn't at all like the idea that you could recognize a building from the way it looks. You can tell it's a fire station. It's got a blooming massive door with fire engines, and it's got the tower for like running up and down.
So look, I've got a proposal, which is that there is more to talk about, and in particular there's more to talk about in terms of suburbia as well. But I think that we might push that into the bonus because it's more germane to the discussion of God's Own Junkyard. So maybe we should do that. So just for everyone else, what we're going to do is talk about Peter Blake's God's Own Junkyard, which was another book of architectural theory produced about 2 years before Complexity and Contradiction.
And he really doesn't like it.
Which he really hates. And I think we also might talk a bit about this interview in Content, the 2004 Rem Koolhaas and OMA book, where they have an interview with Venturi, Scott Brown, Koolhaas and Hans-Ulrich Obrist, which has got some sort of interesting bits in it. Anyway, so if you want to join us for that, the Patreon is at patreon.com/about_buildings. Well, I wanted to say something, which is that although Venturi, Scott Brown sort of disown their own relationship to postmodernism in architecture, I think that you can see so clearly what this building does, which I think is the distinctive shift from modernism to postmodernism, which is the way in which it foregrounds communication within like what the proper function of a building is. So it's not that there was no architectural language before or whatever, but the way that it sort of pushes that right to the top of the pile as the sort of primary and kind of articulated focus of what the design is about, I think is something which is distinctive to the postmodern.
Yeah, and he says you should also combine that with historical models. Yeah. I mean, that is like combining explicit sort of symbolism and historical models is a lot of, it's not all of postmodernism, but it's a lot of it. I mean, what postmodernism is, the other thing I wanted to say, it's also got like you should be looking at, you know, modern vernacular, you should be looking at mobile homes and Winnebagos for your future. Yeah. But it also has something which I think is like one of his unrealized, like, well, if you really believe this, why didn't you just try and do it? He says what you should do for your, he talks about a town hall. What they should have done is just made a box with all the offices in it with a huge billboard on top saying, I am monument. But he never does anything like that, and he just sort of means it's a joke. But there is a picture of that at the end, which is a very famous picture.
Yeah, he doesn't follow through on that.
He usually pulls his punches. He doesn't really believe his own theory. But he doesn't stand at a wry distance to it either. He doesn't say this is a joke. He just chickens out. Chickens out. We come from a particular sort of time and space, and I think it's made us particularly unreceptive to this. I'm not sure if I would have bought it at the time. Maybe I would, maybe I wouldn't.
Well, there was a big outpouring of like appreciation for him when he died, and it did make me sort of try and think twice about my past reaction to him, but I haven't been able to get over it. I still find the theory deeply irritating.
Like, I don't like his buildings. I don't really like his theory either.
Yeah, I find the theory kind of, yeah. I find the affect deeply irritating. I find the way in which kind of erudition and folkiness is deployed, like, kind of makes my skin crawl. I think that the architecture is by and large a failure, and I think that the theoretical project is kind of irresponsible. And yeah.
I don't think it's kind of irresponsible. I think things, there are a few things that he said. Most of the contents of these things, of the two books, I'm neutral about. And then in both cases, there's a couple of things that I've said which are actively terrible. Yeah. I think the advice that everyone should live in, he doesn't say it, but it sounds like I'm putting words into his mouth when I do that. But he's like that with everything. He kind of elides all his comments. It's like when he's saying the building's bad, he says, I don't think this is a particularly bad building. I just think that its expression is worthless and hypocritical and it's a waste of money and no one will like it anyway.
Yeah.
And he's like that with the theories. He sort of says, it's not that I'm saying that everyone should live in really small, dark, air-conditioned boxes with nothing to them and they should just watch TV until they die. But I sort of do think that. Or I am sort of proposing that. And I sort of think that everything should be like commercial boxes with a dressing. Yeah. And and I embrace that.
I mean, I think on one level, I do endorse, I'm very much in favour of the idea that there's a lot to be learnt from actually existing conditions and things which happen regardless of whether they're, you know, high or low art, to use a rather old-fashioned... Yeah.
But I mean, that's a battle that's been won now, so in a way, it's less relevant.
In all sorts of vernacular, I think, are worth studying and worth deriving, taking on their own terms. I think that to add one last kind of crime, I find the way that he uses a type of populism or a sort of thing of saying, the common man, the market or whatever, kind of endorses this, therefore...
Yeah,
I stand
but just
behind
making
it as
himself
well.
A voice of it as well.
Yeah, and in this way, which I think is like, yeah, I think that there are lots of things wrong with it. I kind of want to talk about it more in the bonus because I think it's much more related to the stuff that will come up in that.
Yeah, but just saying like, just because something is provided by the market,
yeah,
it doesn't mean that's what everyone will make everyone happiest. I mean, it doesn't mean that, like, that ain't necessarily untrue. It may be that the market is provided, but you can see that often when people have a choice in the market, the offering will improve, and it ain't necessarily what people were doing in the 60s.
It's also much more like the question of what the market even is when it comes to things like, you know, post-war residential development is... It's complicated and
people definitely wanted indoor plumbing.
Yeah, but you know, the urban form of the buildings that were built by private developers in the post-war come from an awful lot of different influences, and to suggest that they are the result of like the invisible hand of the market or some kind of social consensus, I think is to turn blind eye to
it.
Or like there was an awful lot of other stuff going on, but I want to leave that because I think it's a longer conversation.
It's a super imperfect market. Houses are a super imperfect market due to lots of things, and I think you'd need to be an extremely strange sort of economist to think that's not true. Well,
thanks a lot for listening.
If you have a really if you really disagree with us, send us an email.
Send
I'd love to hear
email.
It.
Yeah,
I really do. It's very nice when people. I don't mind it. It's nice when people disagree.
Yeah, it's good. It's good.
We're all about a conversation.
Yeah, thank you very much for listening. It's much appreciated. Yeah, you know, I hope you're having a good 2019.
We'll put images out I say we, I mean Luke does basically all the work.
All that stuff goes up across a broad range of different social media sites.
Instagram, Twitter.
You can find us.
All you millions of Mastodon users out there, you can even use that.
We're at about underscore buildings on all of those.
Yeah. Gosh, competent.
Yeah. Our editor is Matthew Lloyd Roberts.
What's our email address?
Our email is aboutbuildingsandcities@gmail.com. And we've got a website at aboutbuildingsandcities.org. What are we listening to? Probably some kind of Las Vegas thing.
I've just been listening to so much Bowie. It's really good. But I don't think we can put that on. Something else.
Yeah. All right. Until next time. We're going to glide gently away.
Yes, to our miserable rabbit hutches.
Yeah.
We're going to watch TV until we die.
Yes.
Good night.
Night.